Welcome to On Deadline, your radio news from Odyssey newsrooms across the country. I'm Christy Strausser, Odyssey's managing editor of news. Let's talk tech, starting with Uber. You know it as the rideshare provider, but it turns out they have aspirations to be much, much more. Here's KCBS in San Francisco.
We're joined by Bloomberg's Natalie Leung. Uber, continuing its aspirations to become an everything platform as it partners with Expedia to move into the hotel booking sector. So, Natalie, how is this going to work with Uber and Expedia?
So you'll be able to book hotels within the Uber app. And Uber is saying, because they already have your payment methods and sort of your phone number and other contact details, this will sort of make it a very seamless experience. And they're doing this because they think they're already big part of people's travel plans. About 15% of ride bookings happen to or from the airport. So they want to extend their app to more parts of people's travels.
I guess that makes sense, right? You're getting an Uber from the airport taking you to the hotel, so why not get in on the hotel bookings as well? But is there going to be, I don't know, a discount? I mean, is there a reason why people would go to Uber rather than Kayak or Hotels.com?
Yeah, so this really is an effort to boost Uber's paid membership program, Uber One. And because Uber One members will be able to get discounts if they book hotels on the Uber app. And this is really Uber's effort to gain user loyalty, you know, get more people into the membership and sort of get them hooked on keep booking on Uber.
Yeah, I can see that being a loyalty thing. Is this already in play, and how's it going?
Yes, so they announced this last week, and they are going to add vacation rentals from Expedia's Vrbo brand as well in the future. And as part of the partnership, sort of on the flip side, within the Expedia app, they will also allow people to book Uber rides. So this is sort of like a two-way partnership to encourage people, existing users, to explore the two services.
This is really becoming an everything kind of platform. I mean, imagine, you know, that they're going, since they already do food delivery, they would probably say, hey, you know, here's a good restaurant that's kind of near your hotel.
Exactly. And last week, they also introduced a new travel mode where people, when they arrived at their hotels, they can explore nearby restaurants. And if they don't want to opt for the hotel room service, they can order Uber Eats like actually a lot of people do. They can order Uber Eats delivery to their hotels. And to make it even easier, the company is defaulting to, you know, add cutlery. Because, you know, your hotel room might not have disposable cutlery.
Well, that's a good idea. Okay, so you said that they announced this last week. Is it up and running? And have people been, what's the response been? Are people loving it?
It's still pretty early. They announced it last week at their annual product event. But it's really about boosting the membership program. And Uber will be reporting their results tomorrow, so we'll likely hear more from their management tomorrow.
What does the Uber One membership look like now? Is it pretty robust?
Yes, they have thousands of members, more than 46 million of them globally, and it's one of the main avenues for the company to cross-sell their ride-hail and also delivery services. And this is one of their main efforts to sort of get people to keep coming back to the service rather than rivals.
And is this primarily for business travel, or is it for vacations, or is it both?
It would be sort of both, and maybe even more for regular consumers. Sort of like how different hotels have come up with their own loyalty programs or even, you know, credit card programs. I think what Uber is trying to do here is try to build a habit, a new habit among customers, to think of Uber as another place where they could get discounts on hotels, you know, when they book their next trip. And as you build that habit, they hopefully will have more customers using this new product.
If your travel loyalty was with Spirit Airlines, you're out of luck. But what to do if you booked a flight on an airline that no longer exists? Here's KYW in Philly.
Pennsylvania Attorney General Dave Sunday is offering tips to customers affected by the shutdown of Spirit Airlines. Sunday says consumers should act quickly to recover funds. He says contact your credit card company to dispute charges. If customers don't receive the refund, Sunday says they can file a complaint with the Bureau of Consumer Protection. Because Spirit filed for bankruptcy, certain types of claims may be subject to court proceedings. The Attorney General's office says you can contact them with any problems.
Speaking of travel, no one wants to go alone. But what are the rules when you travel with friends? Here's Noon Business Hour from WBBM in Chicago.
Traveling with friends sounds like a great idea until you're arguing about money, sleep, or what to do next. Before you book that trip, there are a few conversations you need to have, even with your closest friends. Joining us, Mark Walters, Walters World Travel and Culture. And how often does this happen to people where after a couple of glasses of wine, you know, two real, you know, good friends get together and they say, let's rent a house this summer. Our families will hang out for a week and it's going to be great. And then when that summer house vacation is over, they don't talk to each other for a couple of months.
Oh, yeah. No, it happens more often than you can imagine because every glass of wine is another trip we could go on together. That's why it's really important that you do communicate before you go because you want to save a friendship because the best part of having a trip with friends is having friends afterwards.
And then what are some things that you can do as part of having those honest conversations to make sure that not only you get through this trip with your friendship intact, but your budget as well?
Yeah, so one of the big things where a lot of the kind of strife comes from is the money. Because like you might have one friend that wants to go to five-star restaurants and other ones that wants to go to Aldi and cook at home. And that can cause a big kind of strife. So it's really good to talk about spending habits, how much do you want to spend on food, you know, how much willing to pay, these kind of things. Because that money thing, if you don't feel comfortable talking about the money thing, then it might not be something you want to travel with because that's going to be the biggest issue overall.
And in some cases, it may not be the money. You may have one friend who wants to hang out by the pool all day, and then you have the other friend who wants to go zip lining or see everything there is to see.
Yeah, so talking about your trip goals in terms of, hey, now this is my vacation. I want to relax by the pool and do nothing, or I want to do the zip lining. So having those kind of talks about, hey, if you want to do something different, make sure you have the, you know, kind of the talk. Is it okay we do things together or separate? Because sometimes they can have their beach day and you can go zip lining and then we meet for dinner later. Because one of the main things I always recommend if you're going on a trip with friends is plan a day of doing nothing together. So then you have like 3 days of doing stuff together and then a day where you're not together. So you can kind of take a break and then have another 3 days in there. So that's one of the key things you want to kind of think about.
Compatibility also extends to scheduling because, Mark, I come from a family of punctual people. The bus leaves at exactly 7:15 and you better be there maybe at 6:55, you know, just to give yourself a little extra time. But there are also other people who are just like, I'm on vacation. I'm going to show up whenever I want. And that could lead to strife.
Yeah, and that's why wake-up times are important. And you know your friends. You know if they're a morning person or a night person. So have that talk saying, hey, look, I'm going to go out and do this in the morning. Let's meet up later. And therefore, they can have their time and you can have your time. And that's why it's also another good idea to have a conversation of what are your must-do activities. So everybody has the thing they want to do. We can focus on make sure everybody gets to do at least their one of their activities. Because if we do a whole trip and, Rob, it's only your stuff, I'm going to resent you because we never did anything I wanted, which sounds really petty, but that's one of those things. So if you talk about that, hey, you really want to do this, but I don't. So if you want to take this day and do that to yourself for yourself, go ahead. And just having that communication, because that is the big thing. You got to be open to talk to your friends about these issues, because if you're not willing to talk about it, you're going to have issues when you're going to be, you know, traveling together, and that's going to ruin your friendship.
And then ideally, what's a good rule of thumb for the length of a vacation with friends? Because I've done a couple of long weekends, and you just leave exhausted and happy and relaxed and ready to go back to the grind. But if it's 2 weeks traipsing across a continent with some friends of yours, you better make sure that you're on every page and not just a few.
Yeah, and that's why I always say test it out. Go for a weekend. You know, go to Milwaukee for the weekend and have some time to go up to Michigan. Do a weekend together before you do 2 weeks together because you're going to have an idea of, you know what, we have a few issues, but we can work it out by communicating. Or you'll be like, no, I could never travel with them again. And I have friends of mine. We're best friends. And I'm like, I will never travel with them again. And we're cool with that because we don't travel very well together.
One of the questions you'll have to agree on is whether to pay for a first-class name brand resort or a copy of the original. Here's more on Trip Dupes and Other Dupes with Rob Hart.
High prices are fueling dupe culture as consumers swap premium brands for lower-cost alternatives that deliver similar style, function, and overall experience. Bob Phibbs, CEO of The Retail Doctor based in New York, and in previous editions of discussions of dupe culture on this program, we've talked about vacation dupes, where you go to, let's say, a cheaper wine country compared to Napa or Sonoma, or maybe going to Holland, Michigan instead of the Holland in Europe. But this is now extending into the retail space. And it seems like the advantage today, Bob, is that the store brand is probably of higher quality today than it was 30 or 40 years ago.
Well, I think you're right. You know, retailers think that dupes are all about price, but they're really about trust. I mean, when a customer just believes that they other option is going to give you 80% of the experience, the premium brand really hasn't earned its story. And the price isn't really the problem for these retailers. It's that perceived value. I'll never forget, I was sitting in first class and I was going to Los Angeles one time, and this guy had this beautiful Rolex on next to me. And I was like, wow, that is a beautiful Rolex. He goes, you know the one thing about it? I go, no, what? He goes, the number one question people ask, is it real? I was like, oh. So that idea of dupes has been around for an awful long time. But, you know, even Target is talking about how they're knocking off all these other products with their own, as they're all calling them, everyday lines. And I think it is it's a big story, because ultimately that whole idea of stack it high and let it fly, when everything looks the same, the customer just says, well, I'll go with the cheaper one, right?
But it seems like there's a big difference between a knockoff Rolex or a potentially knockoff Rolex, which carries with it the implication that you're lying to people or you have been had, versus the cult of Kirkland that is built up around Costco diehards. I mean, people love not only Kirkland clothing, but Kirkland wine, Kirkland bourbon. You slap the Kirkland logo on it, people who go to Costco members, they'll buy it.
Well, I think there's always going to be an element of people that want the whatever the cheapest is, right? There's an $80 serum that you can get at a fancy department store. You can get a $15 drugstore version. It's rare that anyone buys the exact same thing and compares them, though. Do you follow me? It's rare that you would go and find that one in, Wayfair or Amazon, and you'd order the exact same thing in Restoration Hardware and go, oh, I see the difference. So a lot of it just comes down to, I can get something that gives me close enough. And I call it settling myself. So I am a premium guy. And I find that, you know, when something costs a little bit more, someone thought a little bit more that, oh, well, this is why you do that. But I think people are willing to settle for it. And there's a whole budget-inspired look now, right? How sneakers are cheaper and they kind of look like it. But to a real sneakerhead, they're going to know it has to be the Nike swoosh on the side.
What is the difference today between modern dupe culture versus, let's say, going to an outlet mall 25 years ago to get a bunch of remaindered merchandise?
Well, part of it is that even in the outlet malls, that merchandise is created just for the outlet mall. So it may have the brand that you know, but when you actually go to one of their full price stores, you're not going to find that same merchandise. And, the other thing that has changed is in packaging, particularly in grocery stores, where we've gotten rid of the fancy packaging anyway. So the product looks very similar, and they're trying to get the same wording out as close as they can, because business, you know, at the end of the day, the company is happy they made a sale. But I just go back to the years and years, and I've been doing this for a long time, my friend, and brands are bought up over generations. And that's what gives you that trust. And I think when the brands start to falter and everything becomes price, I think things get a little dicey, because it is not the same thing. It's something that's 80%.
And when you're shopping, should the retailer be collecting biometric data? Many of them are using cameras and AI to track facial recognition. Others scan your palm and more for personalized marketing and walk through checkout lanes. There's an effort in upstate New York to end the practice. Here's WBEN.
Erie County lawmakers will debate a bill introduced by Lawrence Dupree that would ban businesses from using biometrics. He says it's a step further from a bill Lindsay Larigo introduced earlier this year calling for businesses to disclose to customers any use of biometrics.
As we went through, I got a lot of comments from the community about it needs to be a little stronger. Transparency isn't enough. And as I talked to more experts, it felt as if that's what we needed to protect consumer privacy.
But Larigo says a ban is not realistic.
I don't think that in today's world it is realistic to ban biometric data collection altogether. They use it at Sabres games. They use it at the Bills games. We know that big box stores are using it. I think if this type of security measure can be used, I think it's really hard for the government to come in and tell businesses altogether that they cannot use it.
Speaking of AI and biometrics, are we doing enough to keep kids safe? Here's Adam and Jordana on WCCO in Minneapolis.
We need real guardrails on AI for the safety of our kids. And there is one group that is literally trying to do just that. Common Sense Media is creating a test that they're saying is sort of like a crash test dummy to help kids in the future and to be able to protect kids in the future from AI. It's called the Youth AI Safety Institute. It's an independent research lab designed to use AI models specifically for their impact, how they impact kids and teens. I wanted to know more. I wanted to know about the testing, and I wanted to know when we could put this into practice pretty quickly. So we've reached out to Common Sense Media, and Jeff Fowler is joining me this morning about the Common Sense Media Youth AI Safety Initiative. Jeff, welcome to the program.
Hello, hello. Thank you for having me.
Okay, talk to me about this. You say it's like crash test dummy testing for AI. I know what that looks like when they're actual crash test dummies, but how are you guys implementing these tests at Common Sense Media?
Yeah, well, the idea is we know that American kids are already using AI. They're using it for a school. They're using it sometimes to help with homework or maybe even take shortcuts on homework. They're also using it for social things. A lot of 50% of American teens use a chatbot for companionship. Mm-hmm. Even say sometimes it's better than talking with their friends. So we know they're using it, but nobody right now is really checking to make sure that the products that they use don't expose them to a lot of particularly terrible kinds of harms. I'm talking about things like chatbots that might encourage them to hurt themselves or commit suicide or give them really dangerous advice or give them mental health or emotional challenges. I mean, this is a long list of the things that could go wrong. Like there's like exploitation and you name it that could happen. So what we're doing is we're beginning a process of setting some standards for like this is okay and this is not okay for children of certain ages to experience with AI things. And then we are testing to make sure which of these products meet those standards. So I'm sorry to go back to answer your original question. How do we test it? Well, there's kind of two ways. So the way we're starting out is we have experts using these apps, these tools, like we're teenagers. So, for example, we have a whole bunch of psychiatrists who've been working with us to test out some AI apps that teenagers use for therapy. And they've been going through having conversations as if they're a 13-year-old and then seeing how it responds and then seeing does it respond in a way that a professional therapist would respond or does it respond in a way that is harmful. And when we discover that something harmful happens, we repeat the test and we repeat it again and again so we see if it's really a problem baked into the product. And when we discover that, we publish the results to the world and we let everybody know this product is or is not safe or has risks that are too high for teens to use.
And when you say products, you mean like Grok and Google Gemini and ChatGPT. Is that what you're testing?
Yes, but also so much more. I mean, look, so yes, everybody knows that there's these big chatbots that are made by the biggest, you know, tech companies, the biggest companies in history, frankly. So ChatGPT, Gemini, and those are also sometimes called the foundational models. And that technology, though, then gets pumped into lots of other things. I mean, there are dozens and dozens, hundreds of other purpose-built AI products that use this technology that kids might interface. For example, some kids at school are using AI tutors Some kids are using AI toys now. AI Barbie is just around the corner. So there are all of these different ways that young people are going to encounter or are already encountering this technology. So we want to test it all, both the big chatbots and all the other things that they're using, sometimes which, you know, claim to be safe for kids or claim to be medically approved or, you know, therapist approved. But are they really? You know, what are they really doing?
And parents, to find out about this, is it like what you've done in the past, like with movie ratings or things like that? Do they go on to Common Sense Media and look to see which ratings are okay or which products are okay? Or are you publishing these somewhere else that parents can look at or school districts can look at?
Yeah, great question. So we just launched the Institute yesterday. So part of our work now is to figure out the best way to get this information into the hands of parents and schools, as well as to figure out what all those standards should be that I mentioned, like what is and is not acceptable. For now, we are publishing what we're calling risk reports on the Common Sense website. Anybody can go there and find it.
Mm-hmm.
And risk reports take on some of these biggest tools and sort of lays out for parents or educators, okay, here are the risks, what is acceptable and unacceptable. And so we cover there already, you know, ChatGPT and lots of other of these tools that you've already named, mm-hmm. and lay out really some of the problems. But as we go forward, we're trying to get even more systematic about it. So you mentioned crash test ratings mm-hmm. for cars. So as you may know, like cars get like a literal rating from a nonprofit that rates cars. We're going to be the same way with these AI products. So as we continue this work, we're going to be testing these systems like in an automated way, right? Where like we can keep testing them, because one thing about AI is that it keeps changing, keeps evolving. The industry likes to say it keeps advancing, but it doesn't always go forward. Sometimes it goes backwards.
Right.
So we have to keep retesting to see whether these things are meeting the standards.
And once you publish or you get some results and say, hey, this is a good one, this isn't such a good one, or here are the risks with this one, what can parents do with that information, or school districts do with that information? Do you give them ways to access parental controls, or is it just really information that they beg their kids to stop using, you know, ChatGPT?
Yeah, well, at the base level, it's information that the parents and educators can use about what is and isn't okay for young people to use. In the case of schools, it might be, you know, their procurement decisions. Like, what are we going to spend money on this AI tutor if this, you know, if the Common Sense Youth AI Safety Institute has discovered that actually it does something called cognitive offloading. It allows kids to, like, not think and then instead take shortcuts. Like, that's not a good tool to have in school. And for parents, you know, it might be like, you know, we recommend that parents know what apps are going on their kids' phones and maybe approve them before they're downloaded. So maybe they'll be able to check and say, hey, did this one make the list of age-appropriate AI tools for kids? And if it didn't, you have a conversation with your young person about how that's not appropriate for them right now. The taking another step back, there's another really important audience here is the tech industry. We want them to compete to make safer products. This is how we got safer cars, right? All those crash test ratings caused car companies to say, we don't want to be on the list of like not safe cars. So they started strengthening cars. And guess what? Cars got safer. And what's interesting about that didn't take like a new law from the government. That just took, a race to the top with the industry wanting to be seen as safe. We think the same kind of pressure can work on this, on the tech industry.
Now, speaking of the tech industry, you are funded, or maybe these studies in part are funded by OpenAI and Anthropic. And tell me if I'm wrong. Is there a conflict of interest? Are they pressuring you to say that their products are safer?
Sure, I'm glad you asked. So in a word, no, we are totally independent, just like Common Sense Media has been for the last two decades. Mm-hmm. And parents know and trust us for giving them good advice about the media that their kids consume. The tech industry, we're based in San Francisco. The tech industry knows that we are among their most vocal critics at times.
How are you guys at Common Sense Media viewing AI and children? And is it with a sort of a tainted negative view, like this can't be good? Or are you seeing some positives about AI?
Such a good question. I like to say that I am neither pro AI nor anti AI.
Okay.
I am pro kid. And so what does that mean? We're not here to scold parents and tell them, like, you must remove all AI from your life. And Common Sense understand that we could benefit possibly from something like a tutor, an AI tutor that is more patient than I could be with my son when he needs it. However, if he's going to use such a thing, I want two things to be true. One, I want it to be safe for him. And two, I want it to be effective. Like, I don't want it to just, like, have a big hole in it, like so many of the products do right now, that just, like, gives him a shortcut and lets him do, you know, lets him not learn things. So how do we get there? How do we get to AI products that are safe and are good? And the way we do it is with sunshine. We test these things and we tell the world about it so that the good ones can rise and the bad ones have to get better or go away.
Thank you for listening to On Deadline, your radio news from Odyssey. On Deadline is written and produced by me, Christy Strasser, and by Lauren Barry. Subscribe wherever you get podcasts.